8:30, we have with us live in the studio one more time, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk.
Only once? Only one more?
Yeah. If you both look under your chairs, there will be you'll find a pink slip taped there.
I thought you were going to say there will be explosives strapped under the chair.
I want
to
burn my pink slip.
No, that's in the desert in Nevada.
I thought you burned your pink slip long ago.
I've never had a pink slip.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay, let's not start Maria giggling.
Get a little serious.
It'll go on for half an hour and the reggae people will be here.
We're going to turn the O2 down a bit. Let's jump into this week's show, shall we? God.
You see, when you get going. Okay.
All right. We're talking about the elections.
The elections. Yes. Well, that's
Thank
not
you.
Funny.
So. That's not funny at all.
We're going to...
It's actually deadly serious and more than a little bit depressing. So shall we just ramp it on down
it
a little
is,
bit here?
Yeah,
that's
bringing us back to Earth. Yeah. So we're going to cover county and city.
We want to split this up over the next couple weeks. The elections are not until the third week in September, but more and more people are doing absentee ballots these days. So the current ETHA state that is out on the streets of Seattle, and pretty soon we hope it'll be up on the web when our fine web people who are out of earshot, unless they're listening on the web, so they can't hear this, but they haven't gotten it up yet. But we will have it up also at our website in the next few days, and we will split it up between this week and next week, so we have a chance to talk about Iraq and other good stuff in the last half of the program. But something we do every year, and it is a fairly subjective thing, so the caveat that goes along with it is that these are sort of subjective progressive opinions, and do your own research. Don't take our word for it. But there aren't that many county council races that are very interesting this year. It was 13 seats on the county council, half of which are up in any given two-year cycle. There's actually seven this time because there's also the election for an unfilled two-year term after Kent Poland died this past spring. And that is one of three out of the seven races on the ballot that is actually kind of interesting this year at all. But only two of those three are going to be interesting in the primary election, the third one where Brian Drudowski, former Republican, mm-hmm. Who's played around with the Greens and is now running as a Democrat. I'm sure I'll be picking up the Libertarian soon. He is running as a Democrat for his old seat that he held for five terms as a Republican, this time against David Irons, the man who displaced him 4 years ago. And, two and a half terms, I believe he held. Running as a Democrat unopposed, and Irons is running unopposed as a Republican, so that won't be until November. Meanwhile, you have all of these other races that are being held, and the only two that are really particularly interesting are in the second, the North Seattle district that Cynthia Sullivan has held for a remarkable 20 years without a serious challenge, which tells you a lot about Democrats in the city of Seattle and how rarely, once they attain office, how rarely they face challenges. And we'll talk about this a little bit when we get
That's
to the city
scary.
Council,
That's almost
too.
Half my life.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it's at least three of hers. Actually, it's probably, 10, 20 years. It's probably about a fifth of hers, but she's been around a while. But she is facing a challenge this year from Bob Ferguson, who is a former King County, executive director of the Democratic Party in the county. And Sullivan has taken on a lot of heat and is finally facing a challenge this time because of her unabashed advocacy of sound transit and many of the fiscal shenanigans of sound transit that we've talked about on this program and in past years have happened on her watch. She has been very much the booster for light rail and that particularly troubled project. Ferguson is not particularly great. He has, he's not really that distinguishable in except for the sound transit issue from Sullivan. But 20 years is probably too long for any one person. So we're suggesting Ferguson on that one. And then The other race that is very interesting, and in fact for me this week was deeply and personally depressing because I had to interview all these people, is in Southeast King County, where the district that Pullen used to represent, where you've got one very good Democrat who will go through to the general election in November. Her name is Barbara Heavey. She's a Troy lawyer, very smart, articulate, fairly moderate, which is, you know, representative of a suburban swing district. But on the Republican side, you have got three rabid right-wing conservative Republicans running, one of whom, Pam Roach, is probably certifiably crazy. But she's the woman who, among other things, was reprimanded, got an official reprimand, and it probably should have been much worse, for the brouhaha in the state Senate earlier this year, where she was looking in the private emails of two of her staffers and then fired them because they said unflattering things about her, as many of her staffers have over the years. Mm-hmm. One of the staffers was also one of the same women who claimed that Roach pulled a gun on her at one point. She's a handful, Pam Roach is. So she's running for the race. A former state representative named Phil Fortunato is also running for the race. And then the King County Republicans appointed somebody to fill out Pullen's term through to the election this fall, named
Steve Hammond,
who is an Enumclaw minister, who, frankly, from my interview of him this week, is dumb as a post. However, he is not quite as combative as Roach or Fortunato. His supporters now have filed suit against Pam Roach for parachuting into the district. This is about the fourth time that she's been accused of moving into a district just in time to be eligible for that district's race for elective office. She's done it a couple times for county council. She has lived in Pierce County for most of her adult life in Sumner and Auburn. And then you had Hammond supporters also file suit against Fortunato. He is a business owner who claimed to be indigent because his business was losing so much money so that he wouldn't have to pay the $1,000 filing fee, $1,039. So he handed in petition signatures instead. While they, after certifying the signatures of some of the petitions with the election commission, some of them were challenged and turned out to be invalid. But because the election commission had already mistakenly certified them, they couldn't be thrown out, and he remains on the ballot. So it's been a total three-wing circus. None of them are very good, but if you're thinking strategically, like, which of these wing nuts do you want to have facing Barbara Heavey in November, you can go one of two ways. You can go the extreme route, like, nobody will vote for Pam Roach, so I'll vote for her because, you know, nobody would vote for her in November. But she's got the best name recognition by far, and she might well win. She'd be a pretty strong candidate in November, so I would vote going for the unknown who is dumb as a post, Mr. Hammond, and then
dumb over disgusting. Any day.
Dumb over disgusting. Plus, there's always the downside that one of them might actually win in November. So, you just have to trust that somebody else in the county council will have to show them where the bathrooms are, and we'll take. But I had to interview all four of these folks this week for the weekly, and it was a pretty depressing time of it. So that's the county council. Much more interesting this year is the city council, although, again, here you have several people, several incumbents running for city council who, in fact, I think in all of the races, incumbents are running for re-election. And unfortunately, the races in which most, with the exception of Peter Steinbrück, who's not going to be on the ballot because he only has one opponent, so that'll just go straight through to November. But in the other four races, the council members that deserve the strongest challenges, all three of the four of them do. Judy Nicastro really is the only one who is getting most of the really strong challenges, and unfortunately, she's not really the one who richly deserves it nearly as much as Compton and Wills and Page were. But let's start with Judy first. She's been very frustrating for her four-year term. She's been very inconsistent. She, I think, has sacrificed to expediency and political ambition in some cases, that whole brouhaha with the Green Party over the Nader election a couple of years ago being an example. There's other cases where she's just picked some very odd fights or she's had inconsistent votes. But at the same time, you look at her challengers, and several of them are truly dreadful. And I have to say, the person who will probably win the seat, based on the Jim Compton experience, is Jean Godden, who was by far the worst of the people. And I heard this from The Stranger as well as The Weekly with the editorial endorsements, where she came in and she did not have the first clue as to any of the issues facing civic city council. She had no vision for what she wanted to do on council. It's like, you know, one of these things where she's sort of been hanging out amongst the political elite in town for 20 or 30 years, and this is sort of her, you know, like somebody else would join the Rotary Club or the Garden Club or something. This is her civic duty. She is joining the city council in order to make it safe for the people whose cocktail parties she goes to. And I kid you not, in the Seattle Weekly endorsement interview, she spent half of her time talking about what a great new hairdo Greg Nichols has. Now, if you've been a gossip columnist for 30 years, I would think that when you're running for office, you want to run against that image. You want to convince people that you actually do have some serious thoughts about the city. And instead, this apparently is her life, and this, in fact, is what we can expect from her for 4 years on city council, is that she'll be commenting about, you know, staff people's bodacious parties that they gave last night and, you know, who did what for the Lions Club this year.
Now, before she jumped into the race, Judy's main challenger was Colin Min, right?
Yes, and Colin Min is still in the race. You have several other interesting people in the race. Art Skolnick, who has done a number of different interesting things over the years, particularly around historic preservation. He is running and is a very good candidate in some ways, the best, I think, of Judy's challengers. But you have Colin Min, who's also in there. You have David Ferguson, who's a socialist. There was at least one other who was really pretty troubled.
I was kind of looking at Colin Min for a while, but you know, he's a land use attorney, mm-hmm. and he's come out with this rhetoric about reforming the land use laws to create jobs, which in my mind rings some bells as to he's probably going to be pro developer. So
yeah, very much so.
So I'm kind of inclined not to vote for him, even though he looks fairly good.
Yeah, but Nicastro, I think, is the best of that bunch by quite a bit, actually. With the exception, as I say, of if you really can't stomach Judy Nicastro, then I think Skolnick would probably be the he's probably running for the wrong office. He's probably, you know, right person, wrong office in that case. The other three city council races, as I said, are deeply depressing because in Heidi Wills and Jim Compton and Margaret Pagler, you sort of have the evil side of the city council. Pagler in particular has been truly dreadful. She is. She's position number five, right?
Yeah.
And she's she really hasn't polled anybody particularly impressive here. She's got Linda Averill, who's a Freedom Socialist candidate, and I have to say that their whole thing about we shouldn't be forced to release the name of our contributors because it's still 1950s McCarthy era. I just find that to be pretty bogus. She really has not pulled a lot of strong candidates running against her. Probably the best of the batch is Dick Falkenberry, whose name you would recognize from the monorail, and. Mike Thompson also actually is fairly good.
Yeah. Now the candidate that's getting the most buzz, I can tell from reading the paper, is Tom Rasmussen.
He's the establishment candidate.
Yeah,
and he is pro developer. He is very pro developer.
He is very much. And his only background is as director of the mayor's office for senior citizens. And I'm sorry, but that's not going to cut.
Yeah. No. He is. When you said pro developer for Colin Min, I was going to wait and get to Rasmussen and talk about now. Here is your developer's developer.
This is really the slate, the Colin Min, Tom Rasmussen. This is the pro downtown slate.
No, this is the Greg Nichols slate, actually. Uh-huh. Nichols, for the first time, really, in a number of years among the mayors,
the
has gotten
you
directly involved in the city council race. And he's got a whole slate of candidates that he's sort of quietly running, you know, because of the relatively poor relations between the mayor's office and city council. He's trying to get his own sort of constituency on the 11th floor.
Moving along,
you have position number 7, in which Bob Hageman, who has been running for offices forever, and Crystal Wood, who any year now will be running for offices forever, are going up against two other candidates, Heidi Wills, who is a fundraising machine, and probably the most serious challenger to Wills, and a fairly good candidate, is David Della, who has a long history of activism in the city. He actually was the third of the three Filipino activist who was supposed to be at the meeting in the early 80s in which the other two were assassinated by Marcos's goons around the union organizing and the old early days of Lilo, for folks who have been in the city 20 years. He's an ID and a labor and a Filipino community fixture. Has run for city council, I think, 8 years ago. No, 4 years ago, I think he ran. He is lining up to take on Wills this time. And, you know, with Wills and with Compton, who is the next race, these are folks who should have been hurt by Strippergate much more than Judy Nicastro. And Strippergate, in turn, shouldn't have been the political scandal. The scandal should be the 8 lobbyists that Paul Island and Vulcan Enterprise, Vulcan whatever it is, you know, Spock Enterprises has up in City Hall. I mean, you know, you've got Paul Allen really getting anything that Paul Allen wants in terms of the city of Seattle, and that includes any of the votes on city council that he wants, and it's dreadfully corrupt. And people like Wills and Compton are, you know, if people remember the brouhaha a few years ago around the mayor's office and the vote for the fire department budget and the notes being passed, and Jim Compton, you know, quickly changes his vote. Well, this is retail politics. This is how it's done. It's, you know, you give me this and I'll give you that in your back pocket type politics. And these two are the prime practitioners of it.
Heidi Wills and Jim Compton.
Heidi Wills and Jim Compton. Compton is running against three other candidates, I should say. One of them, John Manning, you want to avoid at all costs. He was on city council in 1995 for less than a year before he was brought down by the third allegation of domestic violence against him. He was convicted and went into some anger diversion or management program or whatever it was. Although remarkably, he's a former cop, and in his first run for office when he was elected to the old Sam Smith seat, for some reason, the first two accusations of domestic violence weren't enough to bring him down, but the third one was. Well, here we are 8 years later. He's running for office again, absolutely unapologetic about his background of domestic violence. Doesn't think it's an issue, thinks that voters will have forgotten. Really, really quite reprehensible. Avoid him at all costs. The other two that are running, you have Susan Harmon, who she positions herself as a progressive candidate. In the endorsement interview, I have to say, I could not figure out why she was running, and she certainly didn't sound progressive. She didn't, you know, she really, all she wanted to say was that she wanted to make little children smile, basically. I mean, she had nothing really that she was running on. And Angel Bolanos is running a very spirited campaign. His English skills, unfortunately, he has a very thick accent, and it's not just that he's an accent, he's from Ecuador. His English is his second language, and, you know, bless him, because I would certainly never want to run for an office in a country where I didn't speak the first language. But it's been a struggle for him, I think, a little bit, and that's kind of gotten in the way of his campaign. But if he were to vote on council, he would be much, much better than than Jim Compton.
He's worked pretty hard for this.
Yeah, and Compton has been just dreadful. I mean, he really has been very bad. So, you know, I don't think Bolaños will win. I do hope that he at least gets through to the general election. So I would say Ángel Bolaños for that. Going back through again, just number 7, David Della. Number 5, I'm suggesting Falkenberry. And then for number 1, the incumbent Judy Nicastro. And Peter Steinbrück when he is running against a fairly minor candidate in November.
And I largely agree with those.
Any disagreements?
We agreed. That's
great. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm.
We'll leave it at that.
And we'll leave the rest of the ballot for next week.
Very good. All right. Well, let's jump to this week in Iraq. There's, of course, been more developments.
Oh, there has. Folks probably have heard by now about the massive car bombing in Najaf, in the city of Najaf. A car bomb exploded outside of the Imam Ali Mosque, just as prayers were ending.
And for Shiites, this is like the holiest city.
Yeah. And this is a shrine, this mosque. It's not just a place where people go to pray. It's a place that's sacred to Shiites all over the world.
The birthplace of Ali, who was the son-in-law of Muhammad, who is considered Muhammad's heir by Shiites around the world.
Right. And over 100 people were killed, including the Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, the man who heads the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Now, that group is probably the one group of Shiites that has been doing any kind of business with the U.S. occupation forces. U.S. occupation forces have tried to meet with other prominent Shiite clerics. Most of them have brushed off and postponed meetings with Paul Bremer. But the Supreme Council has met with them. Al-Hakim himself was in exile for many years and had worked with the U.S. forces a little bit before the actual invasion. And his brother sits on the Iraqi Governing Council, which was appointed by Paul Bremer about 6 weeks ago. So this is very clearly this was very clearly a guerrilla attack. Now they're talking about possibly it could have been caused by infighting among the Shiite community, but I very, very seriously doubt that any of al-Hakim's rivals in the Shiite community had the ability to put together a car bomb of this type.
And they wouldn't have done it on that site. No Shiite would have.
I don't think so either. It's pretty clearly that this was just another guerrilla attack, very similar to the one that was done against the Jordanian embassies a few weeks ago, and then last week again at the UN headquarters. This is a new tactic for the guerrilla forces in this war, and we can expect to see a lot more of this. Also, some other things have happened this past week. There was an outbreak of ethnic violence in northern Iraq that hasn't been covered very much by the press here. This is the sort of thing that many analysts were afraid of when the Bush administration said they wanted to invade Iraq and wanted to depose Saddam Hussein, that it would set off a whole lot of problems with ethnic infighting. And the problem hasn't been between Sunni and Shiite Muslims, as was expected. The problem has really been between the Kurds and the Turkmen in the north of Iraq. Now, they're fighting not so much just because, well, you're a Kurd and I'm a Turkmen and we hate each other, etc. They're fighting because the Kurds want an autonomous Kurdish zone in northern Iraq that they will govern. And right now they're doing their best to expand the boundaries of that zone, and the Turkmen are resisting that. It's a fight pretty much over land and over political influence. And the U.S. forces are right directly in the middle of it. And this past week, over the weekend, there was fighting between Kurds and Turkmen near Kirkuk that left 11 people dead, including several of them shot by U.S. forces. So that is turning out to be a major mess. And I think we'll see more of that in the future as well. There was another attack, too, and it's hard to tell whether this was Shiite infighting or a guerrilla attack. I believe it probably was a guerrilla attack. The uncle of the man who died in the car bombing in Najaf, his house was bombed earlier this week, and he escaped injury. However, 3 of his guards were killed. So I think it's very clear that while we've got ethnic infighting in the north, in the south, the attacks are guerrilla attacks, and they're aimed at soft targets, at people who have supported the U.S. occupation.
And you know, really the you have the line coming from the Bush administration of, well, this is a, you know, these bombings are intended to sow anarchy and yada yada yada. There is some truth to that. I mean, there's other clear purposes as well. These were also assassination. These were very clear targets. And you have in the case of the Jordanian embassy, it makes other countries in the Arab world loath to deal with the U.S. Imposed government.
That was the direct goal, because at the same time that the bomb went off, the Arab nations were meeting and discussing whether or not to recognize the governing council.
And then with the UN bombing, you've got many of the relief agencies in the UN have been reassessing their involvement in post-invasion Iraq.
It came 4 days after the UN Security Council decided to acknowledge the existence of the governing council as the beginnings of a democratic government in Iraq.
And now you have an attack not simply on a religious figure, but on also somebody who's choosing to do business with the Americans' council.
Yeah, and al-Hakim had said earlier that he did not support the U.S. occupation of Iraq and that he wanted U.S. troops to leave, but as of late, he had been counseling Iraqis to be patient and to go along with the governing council as a step towards democracy. So clearly, he's being targeted now because he has changed his views.
Yeah, he's changed his views again. He doesn't really seem to be saying much at all these days.
No.
These are very carefully selected targets. They're very thoughtfully selected targets. And the cumulative effect of them is to encourage Iraqis, regardless of the sector of civil society, to not be doing business with, not even necessarily recognizing legitimacy of the Americans, but simply not cooperating, not doing business with them, because if you do, you will be looking over your shoulder at all times. Mm-hmm. So it's that much more than the sowing anarchy that I think is the direct goal. But there also is the impression that is given that the United States cannot keep a lid on things, that they are incompetent. And we've seen this also with the provision of services, where the Bush administration, you know, once they've given out all the contracts they can give out to Halliburton and Bechtel, they just don't know what else to do.
Yeah, and that's actually true. The U.S. can't keep a lid on it,
as we're finding out.
They can't. The other thing I wanted to talk about is that the U.S. is now running out of money for both the Iraqi reconstruction and for the U.S. troop deployments. Now, on Tuesday, it was reported that all the seized Iraqi government assets are now pretty much exhausted. There's about one payment left in the account to make for Iraqi civil servants, and after that, it's going to be coming out of the U.S. Treasury. Now, no foreign governments are ponying up aid money yet, and the major donors conference that was supposed to be where the U.S. would ask major foreign governments to make some donations in order to run the reconstruction program isn't scheduled until October. So
maybe they could do a telethon.
That's an idea. I wouldn't be surprised if they tried it. And here's another interesting thing. The U.S. thought they had an extra $600 million, and people might remember this during the war when troops uncovered this huge cache of gold bars. They said, oh, here's this huge pile of gold that Saddam Hussein had squirreled away. Well, it turns out that those were not gold bars. Those were melted down shell casings made mostly of copper. So they are absolutely worthless. And there goes an extra $600 million that the U.S. thought it had to rebuild Iraq. But the White House is going to have to line up pretty soon and ask Congress for about $2 to $3 billion just to get through to October, the major donors conference. And what do you want to bet that when that donors conference comes around, the U.S. is not going to be getting very much money out of anybody for the Iraq reconstruction?
No, they won't. And meanwhile, there is a comment on other sources also, but the Washington Post, I believe it was this morning, has a very good article listing, Bechtel and
where the money has gone
and
so far.
Halliburton, you know, Brown and Root, and all of the places where the money is going. And can you say cronyism? And it's a remarkable list of all the big contributors to Bush's reelection campaign.
And then Paul Bremer on Tuesday also said that it's going to cost about $13 billion over 5 years to rebuild the Iraqi electricity infrastructure and another $16 billion over 4 years just to get the water system up and running. So here they're talking about projects that are going to take 4 to 5 years. Well, you've already got Iraqis rioting in the streets today about the lack of electricity, the lack of fuel, the lack of water. and it's going to cost tens and hundreds of billions of dollars to get these things fixed.
And those are construction costs that don't assume constant guerrilla attacks and other disruptions right. of the type that we're already seeing.
Right.
So it's going to be expensive, and it's a political mess, a financial mess, and obviously a guerrilla war on top of it.
Yeah, and then this is also on Tuesday, the Congressional Budget Office announced that the U.S. federal deficit will be a record $480 billion next year, and that if all of the tax cuts stay in place, it could be high as $3 trillion within 10 years. And that's before we take into account all these reconstruction costs.
Yeah, right. So, re-elect Bush.
Well, judging by the money he's raising so far, I think he could personally probably pay off a bunch of this. So, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State can be found in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, and other places where you find free newspapers around town. We can also be found online at www.eatthestate.org. That's Eat the State, all one word, .org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to ask us what our sources are, you can give us a phone call at 206-903-9461.